I hope you all are having a very nice morning. My name is Julian Mark, and this is Listen Local, and I'm here with my editor, Lydia Chavez. Lydia, how are you doing today?
Good morning. I'm good.
How did the mission look out there?
It's cool and brisk.
I think that's probably a pretty good thing, or you know, what would we want out of a fall morning, yeah. Right? Sometimes it gets a little hot.
I don't know. We're waiting for that Indian summer.
Yeah, no, still waiting. Lydia, you wrote a story this week and published it yesterday. You went to a meeting at the San Francisco Police Department headquarters. There are quite a few of these kinds of meetings going on at the SFPD headquarters. What exactly happened and what was the meeting?
Okay, just to give people a little bit of background, there are 5 executive groups. They're citizens and police, and they're working on different sections of 272 police reforms, suggestions from the U.S. Department of Justice. And this was the working group on bias. And at these working groups, there are the stalwarts that are there every time, the head of the Human Rights Center, someone from the Department of Police Accountability, someone from the SF Bar Association, police officers, and Tony Chaplin, who's the deputy chief, who is in charge of this particular working group.
So sorry. Let's just back up a bit. Why is the SFPD? Why is it reforming itself? I mean, what is going on here?
Well, what provoked these reforms was a couple of things: a lot of shootings and a lot of accusations that the police were stopping youth of color in particular and citizens of color. And unwarranted shootings, racist and homophobic texts that 14 officers were involved in those texts.
So the SFPD has some issues.
has some big issues, as do a lot of departments around the country.
Right.
And there was a huge report by Obama in 2014, 21st century policing, what it should look like and what U.S. police departments should look like, and an effort, across the country to reform and especially push certain police departments to reform. And SFPD was one of those departments.
And so now, this effort, when was this effort sort of kicked off?
It was kicked off in 2015. Mm-hmm. So we've had 2015, 2016 in earnest. I think the DOGA report came out, in 2016. Mm-hmm. So it begins in 2016. A new police chief, Bill Scott, takes it on, says, we're going to do this. People are assigned to these committees. Anyone actually can attend these meetings, but really only those people really dedicated to this process attend. We try and attend as many as we can. Often, really often, no stories come out of them, but we feel like we should be there to watch the process. Should be there to watch the process.
So the reforms are still happening.
Very much still happening.
Right.
I mean, it's been 2 years.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's not a quick process.
And are they, I mean, what are the, you know, these are, this is arguably, the crux of what reform, I guess, should look like, or what, they've sort of intended for reform to look like. Is this what reform looks like when you go to these meetings? What does reform look like when you go to these meetings?
Sometimes it's unintelligible, unless you've been following it very, very closely. Uh-huh. But the fact is that, I can just imagine that 2 years from now, huge demonstrations in which people are going to be calling for reform, demanding reform. And what should have happened is that some of those people should have been monitoring these reforms all along, because big policy changes can happen and cannot happen as a result of who is watching and who is there.
And so you kind of were witness to one of these changes.
Yeah, I was. I mean, you usually attend this meeting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I sat in because you had to do something else. And I'm sitting there and they are looking at something that the working group, and actually an even smaller group of the working group that included probably 6 people, civilians and police officers, had decided in July of 2017 to make some edits, which had been recommended by DOJ, on the police general order on bias policing, to prevent bias policing. So one of the, they were very happy with the changes they had made. One of the important changes they had made is to, because it had been recommended by many people and many groups and lots of research, that police officers at every stop, at the end of it, they hand the individual a card. On the card is their name, their star number, and also a place where the citizen can file a complaint or file a commendation.
And why is this important?
This is important because if you're stopped by the police and you feel like you should not have been stopped, and maybe you get into a mood, and if it avoids you having to say, as someone who feels like they've been wrong, could you please tell me where I'm going to file a complaint? That's highly unlikely to happen. So the idea is, it's just customer service.
Right.
It equalizes the relationship just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So this was an important change, and it was you know, a mandatory written document, and the working committee didn't care if it was a business card or a piece of paper. Just all of this information should be handed out. They congratulated themselves, and then the next process is for it to go to the command staff. And it's called concurrence review.
And what is it? What is a command staff? What are
command
they?
Staff uh-huh. are the different people who sit, you yeah. know, downtown in headquarters, and they look through this document. Many of the people there who looked at this document have not had the benefit of reading all of the research and hearing all of the arguments right. that this committee has considered.
Right.
It goes to the command staff. So this went to the command staff in July of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
The meeting that I attended was on August 30 of 2018.
Wow.
So they are just then getting the edited version or the comments from the command staff. And in the edited version, the policy on handing this information to at each stop has been changed and has actually just been returned to what it was before, which is upon request. So once again, it puts the onus of having to ask for this on request to the person who has stopped.
Right.
So imagine, for instance, we had the incident which helped kick this off of Firminger being arrested for having stolen all of these. He stops the suspect. He steals things from the
right,
suspect.
Right,
and then
right.
the suspect is supposed to say, could I please have your business card? I'd like to know where to file a complaint. So this was big. People on the committee were upset. And they start talking about this. And Chaplin, the deputy chief, I think understood that this was going to be upsetting. So he called into the meeting another deputy chief who has been overseeing the whole reform process.
Do you know this chief?
This is Michael Conley.
Okay.
And Conley, you know, explains this is just how it happens. We have to, you know, make edits. People in the command staff will have to make edits because we have to consider how these policies are taken in, you know, when the police officer is operating in their darkest hours. You know, sounding as if there were police officers who considered that on the working committee. So, you know, this was changed. People were upset. I was there. I could write about it. And I mean, I wonder, like, if a reporter had not been there and written about this, maybe nothing would have happened. Maybe they just would have shoved it through. But as a result, I think, you know, it helped to have a reporter there. And I think as a result, they're meeting again and this will be looked at again.
So, I'm still a little confused about, you know, what the SFPD said their reasons were for reverting back to this.
They didn't make a whole lot of sense. And they didn't make a whole lot of sense to the people there. One of the things that Tony Chaplin said was, look, no one who is working in a gang, no one in a gang wants to have an SFPD ID card in his pocket.
Right.
Because if his friends find out, it looks to people like he is cooperating with the SFPD.
Uh-huh.
So someone there raised the thing, well, the guy can always toss the card or he can always refuse the card.
And then what did Chaplin say to that?
really nothing. He didn't have it. He said, you know, it's sort of, you don't understand our work a little bit.
Right.
But he did, you know, in fairness to Chaplin, he did say that, you know, we are going to reconsider this again.
I would, you know, I would hate to sort of make you speculate about this, but what is the real reason? You know, what would be the real reason or any sort of set of reasons that, you know, the SFPD command staff doesn't want this policy in place? You know, are they really thinking about these, you know, about the people that they're handing the cards to? Or is there something that is, you know, kind of, I don't know, like this is perhaps some like some kind of drudgery? Or what are they, what would a cop be worried about, you know, with this?
You know, I think it's a complicated question because I think there are probably lots of police officers who would prefer to have it like this so that everything is just very straightforward.
Right.
And I think there are other officers who probably don't want it like this, who feel like it's a bit of control, who feel maybe exposed.
Right.
I mean, the officers now have body cams. They had body cams when this, you know, when the review committee recommended this change. And Chaplin also tried to argue, you know, a lot of things have changed. We have body cams now. But who is going to go through the body cam footage of every stop? I mean, the officers make over nearly 100,000 stops a year.
Mm-hmm.
Who is going to go through that footage and ensure that the officers have done anything? Have, you know, that right. the exchange has been equal, that the exchange has been polite? I have to say, I don't think Chaplin's arguments were easy to buy at all.
Could it be possible that the union is weighing in on this
it
as well?
It could be that the union is weighing in on it. The person who made the change was an officer, Gary Buckner, who, without specifically talking about this change, Conley said there may have been people who opined, who made the edits, who didn't have the benefit of the full research.
Wow.
So, but it, you know, these changes are really important, and it's really critical that people are watching this.
And by your observation, you know, people, you know, a lot of the people who are out in front of Mission Station after, you know, beating the Aztec drums after right. each police shooting, you know, the people who are calling for Gascon's resignation, where, you know, these are the loudest, most in-your-face police critics. Where are they for these kinds of policy, you know, conversations?
You know, it's... I mean, I can't say that I blame them in the sense that you have to go to so many meetings and really sit through a lot of talk that really doesn't amount to much in terms of change. So you're not seeing anything happen quickly. And I think, you know, these meetings happen in the day, and that's, you know, people have jobs. So I think it's very hard. You know, in a sense, it's one reason that we've been trying to cover these meetings and to attend them. But even for us, I mean, we're three people.
Right.
And I've got a full-time job at Berkeley.
I mean, could it also be that these, you know, they are, yeah, they're slow work, but, you know, people who, you know, have been kind of the bridge between the sort of the louder, you know, activists who, you know, kind of take the streets and the people who kind of, you know, go deep into the policy, those people have been discouraged by how opaque the SFPD's process has been. I mean, even for the folks that are willing to, you know, who are deeply invested in it and who are bringing stuff to the table are kind of getting shut out a little bit by the department. Is that
well,
a possibility?
I mean, I think those people, I wouldn't want to speak for them. I think they get
right.
very frustrated. I mean, Cheryl Davis from the Human Rights Commission's, Samara Marian, a lawyer with the Department of Police Accountability, and Julie Tron are, you know, three from the SF Bar Association
right.
are three people who are always there, who are incredibly well informed, who have done their homework, and who are really trying hard to work with police and believe that they have, I think, built up a relationship with the officers who are participating in this. So, I mean, to me, they could just are kind of amazing, you know.
And, you know, from kind of, you know, your associations with them and watching, you know, observing them at, you know, at least this, you know, this one meeting, are they assured or are they frustrated or, you know, what is the mood for these people who are deeply invested?
I mean, I think they were very surprised to begin with.
Right.
And I think they were but they very calmly take in this information and try and work with the police. And I think they believe they can get to a policy that they can live with.
Right.
And I think if they don't get there, they will, you know, some of them will be more vocal about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they've got to believe. And they also, I think, are very mindful of their relationship with the police and not wanting to damage it.
Right.
I mean, they don't believe that necessarily the police are the bad guys. They believe that they can work with them.
So, you know, in this police policy and like, you know, with these sort of small changes that are, you know, make it mandatory or would require, you know, police to do, you know, small things that don't necessarily look like, you know, a large indictment of an officer who, you know, who used his gun to, you know, shoot an unarmed mm-hmm. person of color. I mean, are these, do you think, you know, by your sort of observation, you know, over the last, you know, year or so, are these going to help the police department do better?
I do. I think they do. I think these are hugely important because they make so many stops. They're stopping, you know, youth of color and people of color more often, and the data still shows that. And if those interactions, people who are stopped feel somewhat empowered to make a complaint, perhaps officers will be, you know, a little bit more professional in the way they stop people. Not to say that they aren't always professional, but there are incidents.
Right.
So I think it will help. And I actually think it empowers the officer as well. And, you know, there are plenty of very good officers. So,
yeah. Yeah. I think, that's
so we'll continue to watch that. Meanwhile, you covered a story this week over the last couple of weeks on, Clarion Alley. You want to talk about that a bit?
Oh, well, yes, I would love to talk about that. Actually, it was, you know, our colleague Abraham, who took the first two stories, and I kind of, you know, did part three. And basically what happened was an out-of-town artist, she came in and she wanted to... first of all, let's welcome Joe to our conversation here. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Julian.
This is Joe Eskenazi, our managing editor. How was the 14 this morning?
It was lovely. I was the guy carrying a child's bike seat on, and nobody had a problem.
that's very good. Did it move at a good pace? Were there, you know, describe the scene to us.
It was everything you'd want a muni ride to be. It was uneventful.
Yeah, I guess that's exactly right.
No one assaulted the driver. There was no one smoking weed in the back. There was no one who was, you know, creating a ruckus. It was mostly old people.
Oh, that's good. Well, I think you get more of that crowd coming from the Excelsior, you know, than the other way around. Anyway, so an out-of-town artist, she came and... She wanted to paint a mural, and so she got the permission of the building's owner, who had actually, you know, painted over, you know, the mural, a Cesar Chavez mural that vandalized Cesar Chavez mural that had actually been on there to avoid getting you know, a fine by the city. She got the building's the owner's permission, so she started to paint a mural of like these a very sort of vivid mural about the. Depicting the likenesses of these very, you know, sort of these community members, a lot of them, you know, being homeless or kind of, you know, poor. And she called it Walks of Life. And so, you know, this is, I mean, if anything, you know, you think of as of a community mural, you know, a mural of people in the community. This is definitely it.
So then what happens?
The Clarion Alley Mural Project, also known as CAMP, they found out about it, and they were not happy at all. The artist did not talk to them. She didn't coordinate with them, so they you know, disapproved of this mural and said that they would paint over it and replace it with something else.
So I actually took the first snap of her painting the mural.
Mm-hmm.
And told Abraham about it. And that happened, I think, on a Thursday or a Friday.
Mm-hmm.
She was painting over this mural over 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
It involved probably 5 different people from the community. Do you know why CAMP didn't talk to her while she was painting the mural?
That's a really good question. Something that, you know, that we might want to ask camp. I don't know how present they are.
Yeah.
You know, in the alley. Mm-hmm. And maybe they just didn't want to confront her.
So what happens? Do they paint over?
So they paint over it, and they paint over it with a. They replace it with another mural that.
Who painted over it? I think there's some dispute there.
Oh yes. Well, so who painted over it? Actually, the initial sort of painting over happened by an unknown sort of vandal. They used sometime last week between Thursday night and Friday morning. Somebody, you know, very crudely, you know, covered her mural in black spray paint, and that is, you know, the actual, you know, person who did it is, it's unclear right at this point. At any rate, this kind of opened the door for camp to, you know, install a new mural in there, which is a, you know, it's about Indonesian, you know, mythology by an Indonesian artist, which is, you know, it looks good, you know, it looks really nice, but the question is, you know, is this a community mural? And camp, you know, erased, you know, essentially, or wanted to erase, you know, the previous mural because it, you know, she didn't talk to the community, or she didn't
talk to them.
She didn't talk to them, but they, you know, how people, you know, say that they are, you know, they are the community, or they are the gatekeepers of the community. Right. So the question is this, you know, what is community? What is a community mural? You know, is it something that is, you know, that is approved by a community organization that, you know, that curates, you know, a very vibrant alley? Or is it somebody who doesn't necessarily go through these gatekeepers and depicts the community in their mural? So I think that this is a very interesting sort of case study in what community.
We should go around and count how many murals of Cesar Chavez there are in the mission, and I bet you it's a fairly high number. And, you know, Cesar Chavez deserves to be venerated and remembered, but I don't think a mural of Cesar Chavez makes people think anymore. You know, it's the same as, well, there's a cross on the side of a church, you know, whereas a mural of homeless people that you look to your left and right and see the actual very same homeless person there makes people think. That confronts you. That is, you know, part of what artwork should be, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I like the Cesar Chavez mural as well, but it had been vandalized and covered over, so it was, you know, as murals are.
Right.
But, and I agree with you. I mean, this was an amazing mural, and it was an interesting project.
It was very interesting.
You know, that coming from out of town, that she had also opened herself up to these people.
Right.
Anyway, you're going to move on to another story, and I've got to run to it.
All right. Well, Lydia, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's great to be here.
So, Joe, you have been reporting on a very interesting, deep, and kind of a story that has a lot of legs. Josephine Zhao, a school board candidate, was... She had a lot of sort of controversial WeChat messages and radio programs, you know, out on the air. And what happened to her this week?
Josephine Zhao was likely a front runner for the school board position. There are 19 people, which is a lot, running for 3 slots. But Josephine Zhao had raised far and away the most money. She's a politically connected, activist and, you know, organizer, and is one of only 2 Chinese American candidates. With the other being Lee Mao Lovett, who, you know, has been around for a while too, but has nowhere near the name that recognition of Josephine Zhao. Mm-hmm. Her own newspaper column, had her own radio show, was the go-to conservative voice for a quote in much of the Chinese language press. In 2013, Josephine Zhao vehemently spoke against and organized against this state's gender-neutral bathroom bill, which allows people to go into the bathroom in schools of the gender they identify with, which may or may not be what's on their birth certificate. And she's apologized for this a number of times, but the reporting that we did, you know, made it very clear that she is underplaying what she did in 2013 and apologizing for a lesser infraction, which, to take an aside here, is I don't understand the point. San Francisco is a forgiving town, and if somebody said, I had abhorrent views and I behaved abhorrently and disapprove of what I did, that probably would have been fine. But that's not what she did. She claimed that she was misled, that she didn't read it, that she was, you know, that she was misinformed, that she was a naive, that she was a new citizen, etc. But this is somebody who has a master's degree and had been in country 26 years at the time and was in her mid-40s.
And so what happened to her this week? I mean, what...
Well, she had to withdraw from the race after being counseled out by her high-powered, you know, political allies because of revelations of race-baiting and misogynistic messages to the Chinese community, because of mixed messages to the English language community and the Chinese language community, which I think is what probably finally did it.
So all of this, you know, sort of, she has all this terrible material out there. It, you know, it gets raised, you know, in the media, including, you know, very, you know, largely by her own outlet, and with all of these, you know, amid all of this controversy, she drops out of the race, but...
But she's not out of the race, because it's too late. It's too late to get yourself stricken from the ballot. So, you know, some people told me, oh, she's got no chance, but I think that that is presumptuous. You, with a field of 19 candidates, with no incumbents running for the three spots, and with her name recognition still very high, she is still a verifiable opponent. You know, she still could do this. And she has not taken any kind of step to say, if elected, I will not serve. And her moderate allies have not come out and told people don't vote for her. They've done, while they've clearly counseled her out of the race, they have done so with a gentle hand and left the relationship intact, because she was a very useful operative for many moderate candidates, you know, delivering the political hit. You know, calling Sandy Feuer a race traitor and Chinese trash, you know, calling Jane Kim a home wrecker. That's not something that a candidate wants to do him or herself, but it's useful to have people doing it.
Right.
You know, it's useful to be acting as a conduit to the right-leaning West Side Chinese community, people who do not get their news from the Chronicle, people who do not get their news from us.
Now, do you think that if, you know, if her supporters and, you know, very, very prominent supporters like Scott Wiener and London Breed, you know, if they were a little heavy handed, do you think that she would be a little bit more, you know, emphatic and a little bit more genuine about her her dropping out?
Yeah, I think that if they put conditions on it, I think that she would meet those conditions. But those conditions weren't put on it. And I don't want to give too much fault to Scott Wiener, who has, you know, I think Scott was very forthright with me. You know, Scott has always called me back when I called him, and Scott has always taken the time to give thoughtful answers to my questions.
Right.
Not every politician does that, so he deserves the respect. And, you know, it's we should not let those who do not do those things skate while Scott is given a hard time for answering difficult questions. That said, you know, he didn't make those demands of her. You know, he clearly counseled her out of the race. You know, I believe that a number of politicians were taken aback by some of the material that came out, that clearly they knew that there were problems 5 years ago, but they didn't realize that those problems were still around, because as recently as August, she was bringing up her opponent's homosexuality as if it was a pejorative. You know, these are homosexuals whose main point would be to spread ideologies.
Right.
Now, another translation, and I had many translators, you know, up towards 10 or 11 at this point. The term spread ideologies could even be taken as instill ideologies. And if you're accusing a homosexual of instilling ideologies, if that is the claim she was making, that's more insidious than spreading ideologies.
Right, right, right. So where do things stand now?
She is still on the ballot. You know, there. And what's more, in the coverage in Tsingtao, the largest Chinese language daily, the emphasis was that she was pushed out of the race by angry gay people. So, you know, a number of people are going to read that and be pissed off.
And vote for her?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. It's a solidarity thing. And in World Journal, which is a smaller but still influential paper, it was covered very briefly. So people could miss the story altogether. And then she's still on the ballot, so you don't know.
Right.
You know, so that's, I think that people saying that she's done are being presumptuous. I'm not going to say she's got it. But, you know, certainly I spoke to her opponents. They're still worried. And why?